As I said earlier, I'm very happy I can be with you in person today. And now face to face, as your new minister, new interim minister anyway, I face a quandary. There's so much to talk about. We could be here for hours. Actually, how's that sound? There's no picnic or second Sunday lunch to get to today, right? But fear not, because thankfully for all concerned, I am aware of a tale about Mark Twain, who generally had no love for preachers. But he went to church one Sunday, and during the sermon was quite surprised to find himself captivated by the minister's oratory. So much so, he decided he'd put a very generous $5 in the offering plate. The speaker continued, and Twain was astonished to find himself so deeply moved and inspired that he determined to double his donation to $10, which is, if you remember, was a fair chunk of change back then. Well, the preacher then went on and on and on, and by the time the plate was finally passed, Twain took $5 out. So given that our offering follows my words today, rest assured that I won't risk getting myself in hot water by starting a steep drop in the collection. Speaking of hot, though autumn begins tomorrow, our weather forecast still has things pretty toasty, but not nearly so hot as they once got for a man named Michael Servetus. That's S-E-R-V-E-T-U-S. Born a Spanish Catholic around 1506, at about age 25 in the year 1531, Michael Servetus publishes a theological treatise entitled De Trinitatis Erroribus. Say that three times fast. In English, on the errors of the Trinity. This being the Christian Trinity of conceiving the divine as God the Father, Son Jesus, and Holy Spirit. Coming in the midst of various inquisitions that sought to maintain this orthodoxy, you might imagine a book called On the Errors of the Trinity raising more than one heretic hunter's eyebrows. And indeed, the following year, the Supreme Council of the Inquisition in Spain begins proceedings against Servetus, forcing him into hiding to avoid interrogation, which sometimes included torture. Eventually surfacing in Paris as Michel de Villeneuve, Servetus studies mathematics and medicine, and around 1540, close to 10 years after his book's publication, he ironically becomes the personal physician of the Archbishop of Vienna. Things are now serene until in 1546, Servetus makes the mistake of renewing a secret correspondence with an old acquaintance, a French theologian and pastor named John Calvin. At one time, Calvin had also needed to lay low because of his writings, but had now ascended to the unquestioned leadership of the Reformed Protestants in Geneva. Servetus sends Calvin a preview of his latest book, a major work called The Restoration of Christianity. Calvin, in turn, sends Servetus a copy of his book, The Institutions of the Christian Religion, which formed the basis of theology known as Calvinism. With titles like these banging up against each other, we might presume this isn't going to turn out well for somebody. Sure enough, after a long period of lambasting each other's theologies via mail, finally Calvin can take no more. And after cutting off their correspondence, he writes to a colleague that if Servetus ever comes to Geneva, quote, if my authority is of any avail, I will not suffer him to get out alive. I couldn't help this reminding me of a line from the Monty Python and the Holy Grail movie, where one of the giant knights who say, "Nee!" tells King Arthur and his men, "You must return here with a shrubbery, or else you will never pass through this wood alive." But to reflect seriously for a moment, does anyone besides me shake their head at the gap between Calvin's death threat condemnation and the teaching of his professed Lord on love and acceptance? Plus, Jesus was put to death for his radical teachings, and here Calvin now wants to execute Michael Servetus for his. This is one telling example of the problems I spoke of last week that arise when people get stuck in believing that their little W religious way is the only way to the big W way of true spiritual and ethical illumination. And when that happens, how easy it is to unconsciously act in direct opposition to the values one professes. Of course, this syndrome is tragically running rampant in certain cultural quarters right now. Regardless, John Calvin is fed up. And when Servetus publishes his Restoration of Christianity in early 1553, Calvin leaks Michel de Villeneuve's true identity to the French Inquisition in Vienna. Captured there and interrogated in prison, things weren't looking too hot for Mike, or with being burned at the stake, now a distinct possibility, I should say they're getting hotter. But believe it or not, he somehow manages to escape. But the next plot twist has historians befuddled, because while fleeing the region, some scholars speculate towards northern Italy or southeastern Switzerland, where Servetus may have hoped to find a more receptive climate, he crosses the border into Geneva and is recognized at a church service. Talk about being faithful to a fault. Arrested there and tried for heresy under Calvin's prosecution, the Council of Geneva convicts Servetus of anti-Trinitarianism and opposition to child baptism. Perhaps out of a begrudging respect, Calvin requests that Servetus be mercifully beheaded. But the council, also not recalling too well their declared Lord's teachings, decrees that he will indeed be burned at the stake. The heat finally caught up to Michael Servetus, and on October 27, 1553, he is burned alive along with his notorious books. Not a real promising start to Unitarianism, though strictly speaking, Servetus wasn't a pure Unitarian because he sought to radically redefine common conceptions surrounding the doctrine of the Trinity, not abolish the notion altogether. But he's a foundational figure nonetheless, both theologically and politically. One source encapsulated his religious views this way, here abridged by me. Servetus had no use for the doctrine of original sin and the entire theory of salvation based upon it, including the doctrines of Jesus' dual nature and the various vicarious atonement theories affected by his death. Nor did Servetus restrict the benefits of faith to a few recipients of God's parsimonious dispensation of grace, as did Calvin's doctrine of the elect. Rather, grace abounds, and human beings need only the intelligence and free will, which all possess, to grasp it. To me, this carries seeds of both Unitarian and Universalist theology that would blossom in future years. And on the political side, after executing Servetus, Calvin and his council do encounter significant public flack. This emboldens other heretical reformers of the time, and Servetus' thought and martyrdom influences George Biandrata, the physician to King John Sigismund of Transylvania. Biandrata, in turn, influences the former Catholic we met in our skit earlier, Francis David, whose views concerning the doctrine of the Trinity persuade the king to convert to Unitarianism. And it was just 15 years after Servetus' death that, as we heard, in 1568, the king issued a strong edict of religious toleration, the Edict of Torda, that's T-O-R-D-A, the name of the town. And I want to emphasize what a progressive anomaly this edict was, coming as it did amid the near constant religious warfare raging throughout much of Europe. It wasn't perfect. Legal guarantees applied to Roman Catholics, Lutherans, Calvinists, and Unitarians, while other groups, such as Muslims, Jews, and the Eastern Orthodox adherents that comprised over half the population, were only tolerated. And as we also heard, unfortunately, but perhaps predictably, King John Sigismund's Unitarian sympathies did not extend to his Catholic successor. That person rescinded the edict and tossed Francis David in prison, where, as we heard, he became ill and died a year later. Still, by repudiating the establishment of a single mandatory national religion, the Edict of Torda was an historically significant statement of religious freedom and acceptance that helped make the development of modern liberal religion possible. This, in turn, laid early cornerstones of Thomas Jefferson's sweeping wall of separation between religious and political institutions. Since then, many UU figures have carried that same torch of inclusion and tolerance, as of course have others. But while I'm burning to share more stories, about those on whose shoulder we're privileged to stand, I'll need to do that another Sunday, and I will. And move here to two closing thoughts about history in general. One, in hearing about people who have lived their lives with some measure of extraordinariness, there can be a tendency to think of them as imperturbable, as somehow above and beyond the pain and fears and doubts that plague the rest of us mere mortals. But that may do both them and us a disservice, because it minimizes their humanity. Michael Servetus, reporting about when he first learned of being summoned by the Supreme Council of the Inquisition, wrote with understandable unease, "I was hunted far and wide that I might be seized and put to death." And I think it's important to realize that he felt those terrible flames as acutely as any of us would. So when I consider what these and so many other people have endured for their principles, I am humbled. Yet in recognizing the normal human frailties behind the historical facades, it helps me better face my own challenges. The second thing is that historical amnesia has a price. Not only because, as George Santayana famously wrote in 1905, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, but also because if we don't know where we've been, we don't know who we are or where we're headed, or at least we don't know it as richly and powerfully as we might. A study published in the New York Times suggests that children who know something about their family's history may be more resilient in the face of challenges than kids who don't. Why? Because they have what the researchers call a strong intergenerational self. They are connected to those who have gone before them, and they know that they belong to something bigger than themselves. So do we, as UUs, belong to something bigger than ourselves, bigger than the specific congregation. We belong to a long-standing family of brave souls and to a generations-old lineage of expansive love and justice-making. For as our Unitarian Universalist forebears proclaimed greater freedom and tolerance, so do we. As our predecessors envisioned and worked to build a brighter and fairer world, inspired by their courage and love for all life, so do we. Thus, as we strive to embody this in our own lives and time, we can remember in our hearts that we are in good company and always have been. Namaste, and blessed be.